From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, A Terrible Question. War is ugly enough. Careful, discriminating warfare at least looks better. But what if it doesn't work, doesn't lead to victory? Our guest this hour questions the kid gloves. We ask if there's any option, morally, politically, or practically. Tonight, On Point, the demands and limits of warfare that strives to be humane. We begin with analysis of arresting developments in the Middle East. Today, the Iraqi information minister relayed a message attributed to Saddam Hussein calling for pan-Arab jihad, holy war, against U.S.-led troops in Iraq. In recent days, reports have emerged from the region that volunteer combatants are flowing into Iraq from neighboring Syria and Jordan to fight alongside Saddam's forces. Rami Curry is editor of the Daily Star, an English-language newspaper in Lebanon. I asked him about the credibility of these reports.
Well, they're credible at one level, in the sense that people really feel a certain solidarity with Iraq, and some of these people going back are Iraqis, in other cases they're from other Arab countries. I think that does reflect the genuine sentiment of solidarity and empathy and wanting to do something, especially in the contrast with the inability or unwillingness of most Arab governments to do anything. But at another level, I think we've got to be careful to wait and see how many of these reports actually pan out and how many people actually do go and do fight. And so it's something that we'll have to wait and see.
Can you imagine this conflict, Rami Curry, turning into a pan-Arab conflict?
No, I don't see that happening right now. But I tell you what is very likely or very possible, that this could be, in the worst-case scenario for the United States, this could be like the Russians in Afghanistan. The expectation is that their overwhelming military might will bring about a regime change, will defeat the Ba'athist regime in Iraq now, Saddam Hussein will probably be gone, and then the Americans will have to rule Iraq, and then you have a situation that's very similar to the Russians in Afghanistan, and then you could get people rallying from all over the Arab and Islamic countries to go and fight the Americans, like people went from all over the world to fight the Russians in Afghanistan. That's a possibility.
Rami Curry, in a statement read out today in Baghdad, supposedly from Saddam Hussein, the message was, this is holy war, this is a fight for Islam by Muslims. He seems to be appealing on religious grounds to a wider Arab community. Do those words have credibility in the mouth of Saddam Hussein, who's well known as a fairly secular guy? Is that a draw for him, or is it just the image of another Arab nation under attack that is pulling whatever support it's pulling?
Yeah, it's the latter. It's the image, and it's more than just the image, the reality of Arab nation being invaded by an Anglo-American armada against the wishes of the entire world, basically. Saddam Hussein has tried to use the imagery and the rhetoric of Islam before, and not very successfully. He's not a very credible Islamist. He put Allahu Akbar on the Iraqi flag, which means God is great, and it's a pretty transparent and expedient trick, and it doesn't really fool anybody, but it shows you the power of this religious appeal, because people feel great injustices are being done to the Iraqi people, and he thinks that this is the way that he can rally support. But we have to be careful not to confuse many, many people in the Arab world. Their support for the people of Iraq is not necessarily their support for the man of Saddam Hussein or his regime.
So is it not possible for Arabs to see this as a battle for the liberation of the Iraqi people?
You mean liberation in the sense that George Bush is talking about it?
Yes, that is liberation from an oppressive regime, liberation from Saddam Hussein.
No, very few people in the Arab world look at it like that. There are some people, I would say maybe 10-15%. There is a minority that does talk about this. But the fact is there's many oppressive regimes in the Arab world and in other third world countries. And when people look at the local tyrants like Saddam Hussein here, they obviously don't like that kind of regime, but what has really hurt them a lot more for a much longer period of time is the combination of the oppression that is practiced against the Palestinians by Israel at one hand and the tradition of Western armies coming in here since the days of Napoleon about 200 years ago or so. And this is the much longer and much more grievous problem that many people in the Arab world have suffered. So the Western armies coming in here is a much bigger problem than the local tyrants.
And how closely are people watching this conflict? Are they following it hour by hour, day by day?
Oh, I think very, very closely, hour by hour. And people have now a whole range of Arab satellite stations. You've got the Western satellite stations, radios, internet. It's something that people follow closely and listen to the radio and talk about it all the time.
So did they see the reports of the, according to various sources, 7 or 10 women and children killed by U.S. forces at a checkpoint in Iraq yesterday?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is the big story in the newspapers. People talk about it. And every one of these atrocities, whether it's accidental or not so accidental, is something that really spreads quickly. People talk about it. They're angered by it. And the problem is that these things happen in war at one level, but another level is that they wouldn't happen if the American British armies didn't invade Iraq.
Rami Kuri, now that those armies are there, can you recommend a way in which they might proceed that would be less likely to draw this animosity in the Arab world? Is there another approach that might be taken that would have a better outcome for everyone?
It's very difficult to see the war now being wound down, and I don't think George Bush can go to the American people and say, well, you know, it wasn't really quite that bad after all. We can have a ceasefire now, and we've taught him a lesson, and we're going to disarm Iraq peacefully. I don't think that's realistic. I think the Americans have to see this through. The worst-case scenario is that the Americans get bogged down in a Vietnam-style situation. I don't think that's very likely, but there's a small chance. You never know. I mean, taking a city of 5 million people in Baghdad is not an easy thing to do. And the Iraqis are clever, smart people. They're expecting this. They're not going to sit there and greet the Americans with open arms. So taking Baghdad is going to be tough, probably. But I think this is going to have to be seen through to the end from the American perspective. And then the best thing to do is to very quickly do a transition, turn it over to the UN and to the Iraqi people, let them make a transitional government, and the American soldiers should go back to the United States and not to stay here for a long time. That would be the way to cut their losses in the long run.
Rami Kuri, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Rami Kuri is editor of the Daily Star, an English-language newspaper in Lebanon. He spoke with me earlier from Beirut. Air attacks have intensified again over Baghdad, but the bombing raids are nothing like the American bombing of Tokyo or Dresden in World War II, says hard-nosed opinion warrior Max Boot. In a provocative essay this week, Boot makes the case that technology is changing the moral compass of war. This new way of war, with its precision-guided weapons and aspirations of humanity, comes with a price tag. An inhumane regime, says Max Boot, is using our humanity against us. And he quotes from a frustrated hawk of the Vietnam War era, General Curtis Bombs Away LeMay, saying, "More force is more moral, because it ends a war more quickly." Could Max Boot be right? In war, do you need to be cruel to be kind? Can civilian casualties be out of bounds, or are these the price of war? Is humane warfare an oxymoron? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me from Larchmont, New York, is Max Boot. He's a senior fellow in the National Security Studies Program at the Council on Foreign Relations and a contributing editor to the Weekly Standard. His latest book is The Savage Wars of Peace, Small Wars, and the Rise of American Power. His article or essay in the New York Times on Sunday was Sparing Civilians, Buildings, and Even the Enemy. Good evening and welcome, Max Boot.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Max Boot, the Pentagon, Don Rumsfeld, and all the rest have made very much of the humane quality of American troops and even munitions and bombs in Iraq. Are you saying that somehow the U.S. has come to a point where it's making too much of humanity in war?
Well, that is the very difficult issue that we have to confront because, of course, we do want to wage war humanely, and I think we do. I mean, it's ironic in light of the way we're attacked in the Arab world for indiscriminately slaughtering civilians. And in fact, we're doing anything but. We're doing everything possible to avoid killing civilians, despite Saddam Hussein's attempts to get us to kill civilians by locating military facilities and hospital mosques and other civilian facilities. He is trying to get us to kill as many civilians as possible, and we are trying to avoid that as much as possible. But at some point, you have to say, when the enemy is violating the laws of war, you cannot hold back too much, because if you hold back too much, the war just drags on. And the greatest service you can do to both sides is to end the fighting as quickly as possible. And sometimes that means the application of tremendous force and civilians will get killed. But I think in the long run, the civilians of Iraq will be much better off because, A, the war will end, and B, they will be spared the tyranny of Saddam Hussein.
Max Boot, it's a tough, galling, appalling moral issue that we raise. And we know that you, as a thinker, are not afraid of war, not opposed to the application of force. Let's put the moral question aside, if we can, hard as that is, just for a moment. What's the history that you're pointing here to illuminate what you say is a change in the U.S. approach?
Well, the American way of war has become very much more discriminating over the past 50 years. I mean, in World War II, we thought nothing of mass bombing raids that killed tens of thousands of German or Japanese civilians at a time, which was largely necessitated by the fact that, well, A, we were in a world war, a battle to the death against evil regimes, but also the fact that our instruments of war were very blunt and not very precise, and bombing raids tended to miss their targets, so if we wanted to take out one target, we had to basically saturate several miles around, and a lot of civilians would get killed. Thankfully, that's no longer necessary. The instruments of war have become much more precise, and we can be pretty confident that 80% of the munitions being dropped in Iraq are smart bombs, and they will hit their targets 90% of the time within a meter or two of the designated aim point. But you're still going to have mistakes being made, and you have to accept that in a war. A war is never going to be a precise, clinical, bloodless business. It is always going to be brutal, nasty, ugly, and deadly for a lot of innocent people on all sides. And I think we have to realize that's the nature of war, especially when we're fighting against such a cruel and inhumane foe who uses human shields, who puts his forces into civilian clothes, who hides in mosques and ambulances. I mean, those kinds of tactics are designed to maximize civilian casualties, and we do everything possible to avoid that danger, but it's never going to be 100%, and you're always going to have tragedies like the one that happened earlier today when a carload of
women and children, seven, eight, 10 different numbers
right.
have come in.
Right, but that's not the fault of the U.S. troops. That's the fault of Saddam Hussein, who's using suicide bombings as a tactic, and our troops have to defend themselves. And that's and this is what Saddam wants. He wants us to kill civilians because he doesn't care about his civilian population, and he thinks it'll be a black eye for us in the eyes of the world community.
And well, and it certainly right. is. And, of course, however the circumstances created, it's an American soldier or soldiers who felt compelled to pull the trigger there.
Right.
I want to understand, Max Boot, if you're essentially just seconding the Pentagon. The Pentagon is saying, on the one hand, we want to be as humane as we can be. On the other hand, the spokesmen there were not particularly apologetic about those civilian deaths today. They more or less said this is the price of war. Are you just seconding the current policy, or are you asking for something more fierce, less discriminating than is going on right now?
No, I think the current policy is generally a sound one. I mean, I think early on, in the very first days of the campaign, we were holding back because there was a widespread expectation that the regime would collapse at the first whiff of gunpowder, and we didn't want to kill a lot of innocent civilians or damage a lot of infrastructure, which we would have to rebuild, and that was understandable. And so we didn't utilize our full firepower, and we went in there with very restrictive rules of engagement. In fact, rules of engagement that were probably too restrictive.
But I read you as being critical. You're writing here about the U.S. adopting a kind of warfare more chivalrous even than 18th and 19th century warfare, the warfare of an earlier time when only soldiers fought and civilians stood by. Is that what you see the Pentagon doing now?
No, I don't think so. I think that was more what was happening in the early days of the campaign, which, you know, for understandable reasons, because as I said, I think there was a feeling that we didn't have to cause a lot of damage in order to win the war, that the Iraqis would rise up. And I think we underestimated how securely implanted Saddam's infrastructure of terror is, which would prevent the people from doing that. So I think we were naturally holding back our firepower. But I think in the last week or so, we have taken the gloves off a little bit. We've realized we're in a real war and we're going to do what it takes to win it. So I'm not at all critical of what the military is doing. I think they're doing a tremendous job.
We're going to keep probing at exactly what you're telling us here, Max Boot. We're talking tonight about careful war and whether it works, about the demands and limits of warfare that strives to be humane. You can join the conversation. If brutal war is outmoded, is war itself outmoded? And can you imagine a real victory in Iraq with oceans of dead Iraqis, Iraqi civilians? Is it possible that in war you have to be cruel to be kind? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about careful war and whether it works, about the demands and limits of warfare that strives to be humane. My guest is Max Boot. He's author of The Savage Wars of Peace, Small Wars, and the Rise of American Power. His recent essay in the New York Times is Sparing Civilians, Buildings, and Even the Enemy in 21st Century Warfare. Is there any alternative to careful war, to politically aware war? Is the U.S. somehow pussyfooting around this war to spare schools and civilians? Or is sparing civilians essential to real victory here? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Max Boot, I hear you lining up pretty much with the military tonight, but still, I'm reading your essay, and the implication is, or maybe you're softening us up for civilian casualties to come, but you're writing about American targeters turning to lawyers to vet targets of bombing, about an inhumane regime using our humanity against us. You're saying the problem could become more severe when Allied troops enter Baghdad. Are you looking for us to further adjust or broaden the gun sight, to drop the idea that we can be surgical here?
I think we have to be realistic about what war entails. I'm not being critical of the armed forces. I think they are doing a tremendous job under very trying circumstances. I think we need to be as precise as possible in the application of firepower. There's nothing wrong with that. We need to try to spare civilians. That's absolutely the right way, the moral way, and the smart way to fight a war, and I think we're doing that. But what I'm saying is we should not get too carried away with our expectations. There's an expectation now that if any civilians get killed, it's not only a mistake, it's a crime. Literally a crime, because there have been attempts, for example, to charge American airmen who fought in the Kosovo War with war crimes because their bombs killed some civilians. That, to me, is crazy. You have to understand civilians are going to die in war. That is the nature of war. If you are not willing to suffer casualties on your side, on the enemy side, on the civilian side, do not go to war. But if we do go to war, you'd better expect that some people are going to die, and that's... No matter how precise the technology gets, that's always going to be the nature of conflicts. And so I think everybody had better accept that, but also give tremendous credit to the American Armed Forces for their attempts to minimize civilian casualties to a greater extent than any other military has ever done in world history.
So when we step into war, you're saying we step over that moral line, we step away from the idea that there won't be death. War is about death. But in this war, there has been an awful lot of talk about the political necessity of absolutely minimizing civilian damage, death, even damage to civilian infrastructure, because there is a critical hearts and minds battle underway here as well that appears not to be going so terribly well. Doesn't that make hypersensitivity to civilian casualties more than important? Doesn't it make it essential to this particular conflict, Max Boot?
Well, I think we need to be sensitive to civilian casualties, but I think the greatest imperative is to get the war over with as soon as possible. And if using overly restrictive rules of engagement draws out the conflict or results in unnecessary casualties among American servicemen, then I think it's probably a mistake. Now, I'm not saying that's actually happening, but I think that is the danger of going too far. I think that just from a not only from a moral but from a realpolitik perspective, the greatest imperative has to be to end the war, because the longer the war drags on, the more damage we suffer in world opinion, the more the economy takes a hit, and also, more importantly, the more people are dying on both sides in Iraq. So I think that we need to bring the war to a close as soon as possible, and if that requires a greater application of violence, I think that's what it takes. But I think our military is very attuned to these kinds of conflicting imperatives, and they realize the demands that they're caught up in. I think they're doing a very good job. But as I say, I mean, we have to be prepared for accidents like the one that happened today. And I think it's crazy to blame the military for the fact that you know, some civilians get shot up after a suicide bomb goes off at the same checkpoint. Those kinds of casualties are on the head and shoulders of Saddam Hussein, who is a war criminal many times over and is violating the laws of war every single day.
Max, but I hear you saying in some degree we're trying to be at war and not at war at the same time, and yet I hear an awful lot of applause for that hypersensitivity, even in war. Stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Daryl Press, joining us from Hanover, New Hampshire. He's a professor of government at Dartmouth College, and for the past 8 years has been a consultant to the Defense Department's military planning for the Persian Gulf. Good evening and welcome, Daryl Press.
Hi, good evening.
Thanks for joining us. Daryl, what's your take on this? Max Boot, very provocatively in recent days, has raised this issue of have we become too sensitive to waging humane war, raising kind of the notion that we may become so sensitive to that victory itself is impossible, that war is prolonged. Do you see that as a real issue in this war? Do you see rules of engagement too restrictive to permit a victory, to permit an end?
I don't. I don't want to put words into Max's mouth, because I think the things he said on the radio tonight are quite reasonable. He's exactly right that there's no such thing as a clean war, and that we are tricking ourselves and heading toward very bad outcomes if we think that war will be clean. We have to understand it always involves killing. And like Max, I'm very sympathetic with the Marines and soldiers who have to man checkpoints and make split-second decisions about whether the van that they can't see into is carrying explosives or women and children. So I agree entirely with what he said. I think that there's a lot of confusion within the American public about why it is that we're being so restrained and so careful, because I think my point of difference with Max might be that I think we're still being extremely restrained. I don't think in any way we've taken the gloves off in the last few days. And I think there's some misunderstanding among the American people about why we're being restrained. Some of it has to do with American values, but a bigger portion, in my view, has to do with the fact that taking the gloves off or increasing the violence, as I think Max just called it, would not only run against our military strategy, but our longer-term political objectives. In other words, it would actually make it possibly harder to win the war in a strict military sense, and also harder to win our political objectives in the long run.
I wonder if that means that you... Do you agree? And I will put words in Max Boot's mouth a little bit. And Max, correct me if I'm wrong, but Max Boot is writing about technology, the capacity for highly precise targeting, having led us into an attitude, a kind of chivalrous attitude that expects civilians to be largely or wholly exempted. Is there an element of unreality that has crept into American military planning, American civilian thinking about war, and is it on display in Iraq or not?
There absolutely is an element of unreality in that, and there is some confusion about, you know, people do expect that now, because our weapons are so precise, we should be able to win without killing many Iraqis, and that's unrealistic. The point I would like to make is that even if we corrected that misperception, even if people understood that that war is by nature devastating and destructive, there are still good reasons of fundamental national interest for us to be very restrained in the way that we conduct ourselves in this war. So even if we correct this misperception, we still need to keep the gloves on for our own hard-edged national interests.
Max Boot, I'm curious if you fully agree with that.
Well, I think we need to be precise. And I mean, I was very general when I said take the gloves off. Let me give you a precise example of what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. A week ago Monday, a squadron of Apache Longbow helicopters attacked the Republican Guard Medina Division south of Baghdad.
It took some heavy hits.
They took very heavy hits, which was widely publicized. All the helicopters in the group were hit. A couple went down. Two airmen were captured. Now, why did that happen? From what I can figure out, it happened because they were operating under very restrictive rules of engagement that forced them to close within 2,000 meters of the target in order to avoid heavy damage to infrastructure that was around where the Republican Guard was dug in. Now, this past weekend, the 101st Airborne Division attacked the Republican Guard once again with Apache Longbow helicopters. Mm-hmm. But this time, the rules of engagement were relaxed, so they were able to fire from several miles away, which is what the Apache Longbow is optimized for. It's designed to be a fire-and-forget system that fires from several miles away from the target and then escapes before it can be hit. And in this particular case, none of the Apaches, as far as I can tell, took any hits.
But as we approach Baghdad, that kind of approach, I presume, will necessarily mean more civilian casualties. Are you saying that's a necessary trade-off?
I think that is a necessary trade-off that the military is making. Now, I want to be clear, we're still being very precise. Those Apache longbows are still, even from several miles away, they are extraordinarily precise weapons.
But we're headed into urban areas here, and there's a reason that they had rules of engagement that said close to 2,000 feet.
Well, that's right, but I think that what we're doing now is the prudent thing to do, which is to pull back a little bit, because we shouldn't be taking heavy casualties because of these restrictive rules of engagement. At the same time, as Daryl Press says, we do have to be careful about civilian casualties, and I don't dispute that. It's just a matter of where you draw the line, and I think we've moved the line just a tiny, tiny bit in the last week or so, but we're not going to move it too far, because that's not who we are, and that's not how we fight.
We're talking with Max Boot tonight and Daryl Press about But lines in warfare, what can be crossed, what must be crossed, what should not be crossed, what do you think? Can we pursue this war with all the care it requires and still win? Jack's calling from Brighton. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. You got somebody who's on the air who's clearly morally impaired, which shows, I think, where National Public Radio is at, that you are basically defending the premises of this war, which most of the world disagrees with. And then your counterperson to him is also defending the premises of this war.
I think we're not, you judge for yourself, Jack, but I think this is an issue that's emerged. It's on the table. There are pressures now for rules of engagement to be loosened. And as Max Boot says in the last week, they're being loosened. The question here tonight is, we are at war. Is that appropriate or not? What's your view?
Talk about rules. The UN was set up to stop exactly what the United States is doing now. I mean, that rule should override the other rules that you guys are talking about.
Max Boot, respond directly. Here's repugnance with the whole conversation.
Well, this is what I would call the burying your head in the sand attitude. I mean, the reality is, whether you like it or not, we're at war, and we better figure out how we're going to wage the war and also how we're going to win it. And I don't think you can run away from that reality by just pretending it doesn't exist.
Jack?
This is not a question of pretending it doesn't exist. It's a question of, first of all, looking out for the people, including our soldiers over there. The fact that we have these fundamentalisms loose at work. We have the fundamentalism of Bin Laden. We have the fundamentalism of Bush.
But since we are at war now, Jack.
Wait a second. Did I just hear the caller equate Osama bin Laden with George Bush? Is that right?
I think that they are both acting on, shall we say, there's a religious basis to both of their actions.
Jack, I don't want to get lost in those. I don't want to get lost in that conversation. I want to put this question to you, caller Jack. Now that we're in war, and I can hear clearly that you prefer we weren't there, we know that many would and did and do prefer we not be there, but we are. So how would you slice it? Would you still have the most constrictive rules of engagement, even if that meant a longer war, even if it meant more U.S. casualties or not? Isn't it a tough decision?
No, I think this is the wrong conversation, and the fact that the choice of your guest show what I'm talking about basically is not your guest. I mean, he's off the chart. I'm talking about NPR, which is supposed to be a voice of dialogue. The fact that you have moved as soon as the war started to acceptance.
I would really dispute that. I challenge you to look back over our conversations and look at the range. I think what we're trying to do is address what's on the table, what we may be facing. But we take your point, Jack, and thank you for your call.
I just think it's pretty rich that a caller who equates George Bush with Osama bin Laden accuses me of being morally impaired. I think that's pretty funny.
Point taken on both sides. Tom's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that Americans would never support expanding the bombing of civilians. To equate this war with World War II and the bombing of Dresden or Japan is ridiculous. They were the aggressors then, and of course anything was justified in shortening that war because they were killing populations throughout Europe and Asia. I mean, we're the aggressors in this war. Saddam didn't attack us first. I mean, it's just absolutely insane.
So from that, you take, now that we're in war, and like it or not, here's where we are at the moment. No one's suggesting carpet bombing, but in these...
Dead civilians are not liberated civilians. I mean, we're supposed to be liberating them, and now you want to kill them.
Well, I certainly don't, but let me put that to Darrell Press. Darrell Press, isn't that the fundamental contradiction here? And isn't that part and parcel of the problems we're having with our reception in Iraq? Traditional war theory may write off hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of civilians, but in Iraq, everyone is being showed on television all over the Arab world and in Iraq as evidence that this is conquest, not liberation.
That's right. And I think there's something to what Tom was saying, which is, the motivation for the wars against Japan and Germany were not to liberate the poor Japanese and German people from the regimes which were forcing them to do things they didn't want. The motivations in those wars were to conquer these countries and to prevent them from doing the things to us and to others that they had been doing. There are two key differences here. Difference number one is we were quite convinced in World War II that the people of Germany and Japan were already quite committed to supporting their governments and to fighting against us. Mm-hmm. And so there was not the concern, which we have in this war, that bombing of Germany and Japan would rally the people to the cause of their government.
So we should note, just in passing, that Germans in recent months have begun to review all that bombing and say, wait a minute, this was overkill even in World War II, even against us.
Yeah, that's possible. There, you know, obviously the moral questions of bombing Germany and Japan are enormous, and you know you should have ethicists on here to debate whether in a total war against horrendous regimes it's justified. But for the two practical reasons why these two wars are very different are: in that war, we were not afraid that our bombing was going to turn millions of people into our enemies because they already were our enemies. In this war, if our military operations against Baghdad turn just 10% of the people of Baghdad against us, that's another 500,000 people in Baghdad who we're going to have to fight against in an urban operation. That would be an absolute disaster. And the second difference is that in World War II, we really didn't fear that very aggressive military operations against Germany and Japan would rally the world, would rally ethnic Germans or ethnic mm-hmm. Japanese from all over the world to support them. And to me, the biggest strategic fear in this war is that our operations against the Iraqis are going to have exactly that effect, that they're going to rally millions and millions of Muslims and Arabs to basically start believing that perhaps Osama bin Laden's crazy rhetoric is right,
Max,
that perhaps we are a big problem.
Yeah, Max, but let me put that to you. I mean, despite your kind of moderate presentation tonight, aren't you pushing back against a kind of more and more tightly woven world where those big civilian casualties that could be enveloped in previous wars that weren't televised live could kind of pass by and be discussed decades later? Now every one or every half dozen or dozen are mourned over and debated. Some would say this is an admirable restraint on war itself, and hallelujah for it.
Well, I think to some extent there's something to be said for that. There is some admirable restraint, but I think in terms of the current war, I see the situation a little bit differently from Darrell Press. I think the greatest danger is letting the war drag out. I think we can afford to incur some civilian casualties if it's going to win the war quickly, because we take a much bigger hit in the world, in the Arab world, in the world in general, the longer the war drags out, in part, because it creates the illusion that we're not winning. It creates the illusion that Saddam Hussein is successfully standing up to us, which increases his aura of support, especially in the Arab world. I think once we actually win, once Saddam Hussein is deposed, once he's killed or put on trial, I think his appeal around the Arab world will be shattered. His appeal depends on being successful. Once he's no longer successful, his aura will be shattered, and I think the Iraqi people will wind up rallying to a new, more democratic government in a post-war Iraq. I think at the moment they are terrified of rising up because Saddam's terrorist apparatus remains in place, and I think the sooner we can eradicate that, the better it's going to be for everybody, not only for the United States, but also for the people of Iraq.
Darrell Press, I want to get your response to that, but we've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about careful war. It's terrible moral territory, whether it works, and about the demands and limits of warfare that strives to be humane in 21st century warfare. Is there any alternative to careful war, to politically aware war that strives to preserve every life, even as nations make war? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about careful war and whether it works, whether there's any alternative anymore, about the demands and limits of warfare that strives to be humane, as the Pentagon has called this war, agree or not. In 21st century warfare, is there any alternative to careful war, to politically aware war? Is the U.S. somehow pussyfooting around this war to spare schools and civilians, or is sparing civilians essential to real victory, to simple morality? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight are Max Boot and Darrell Press. Darrell Press, I wanted to get back to you on Max Boot's assertion that quicker is better, that it will shatter the aura of Saddam Hussein and ultimately minimize the destruction of this war. How do you look at that calculation?
Well, you know, on its face, I think he's right, that quicker is better, all things being equal. If you can end the war more quickly at the same sort of rate of inflicting damage on the enemy and damage on their civilians, then sure, quicker is better. But if what we're trading off by going quicker is, again, to use the words, taking the gloves off against the Iraqi people, then that's putting military operations before either military strategy or political objectives. The reason we're fighting this war ultimately are for a set of political goals. And if in order to buy a quicker victory, we sacrifice those political goals, then we've clearly not gotten anywhere.
And yet it is a changed world. I mean, Max Boot talks about this terrible carpet bombing that brought victory in earlier wars, and now, Del Press, you, like everybody else, sees the reports on every titch of this war. Is it possible that at some level the world just can't tolerate the destruction that comes with war anymore?
It is possible, but there's another hypothesis. And the other hypothesis says there is something very particular about this war, which was it was sold as a liberation mission. We're freeing an oppressed people from a terrible man who abuses his own people as much as he abuses his neighbors. If this were a different kind of war, if this were a war against literally al-Qaeda, against a group of people who had attacked America, a group of people for whom we didn't have sympathy and we were not claimed to liberate, then I think it's very possible that the United States would fight it quite differently.
And Max Boot, what if the Iraqis who we have set out publicly to liberate tell us, and we see this in TV reports and radio reports in the region, Iraqis saying, look, my sister, my mother, my child has died. This isn't worth it. Get out of here.
I'm not hearing a lot of that. I mean,
well, I have heard it. I don't know whether you've heard the reports or not, but I've heard and read
I don't think anything that you hear, I don't think most things you hear right now coming out of Iraq are very reliable, because when you talk to Iraqi exiles or you listen to the reports from Iraqis who have recently crossed over to Allied lines, they're terrified because they feel that their families are being held hostage by Saddam Hussein. They're not sure who's going to win this time. They remember what happened in 1991 when we asked them to rise up, and they did, and they were slaughtered by Saddam's thugs. They're afraid something like that will happen again. So they are towing the Saddam party line until it appears that Saddam is finished, in which case I think you will see a more genuine expression of Iraqi sentiment. I don't think what you're seeing now is very genuine, but even now what you're hearing glimmers of it. There is a report in the Arab News, which is a Saudi English language newspaper, from a correspondent who traveled into southern Iraq and talked to some of these Iraqis in Basra and so forth, and he asked them, well, why are you shouting these pro-Saddam slogans? And they said, the reason we're shouting these slogans is because we're terrified. We're afraid that if we don't, we're going to get shot, our families will get killed. They're watching us. But in private, what they say is, we don't really believe in this regime. But, you know, a lot of these Iraqis actually express impatience and say, why don't you get it over with? Why are you dragging it out? I think a lot of Iraqis would actually be grateful if we would if we could speed up the tempo of operations and finish their liberation sooner.
There's a fierce judgment's being made. Hussein is calling from Boston. Hello, Hussein. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you? Okay. I think the Iraqi people would have been much happier if we had got this done back in 1990-91. It seems like, you know, we are still fighting a manifest destiny war here, but the victims are not the Native Americans, they're the Arabs.
What do you mean by that, Hussein?
I think that we have a messianic, a Christian messianic view of the world, and that, you know, we have a dialectic. We are good and then they are evil, and so we have to use force to subdue them. And it's funny. I'm so insulted by the fact that Mr. Boot says that we can afford some civilian casualties. Who would you afford? Would you afford children or mothers? I mean, you know, pick the category that you would that ideally you would like to lose.
Max Boot, we'll give you that question.
Well, you know, that is such a nonsensical question. I can barely dignify it with an answer, because the fact of the matter is, it is Saddam Hussein who has killed hundreds of thousands of the people of Iraq. Saddam Hussein has committed genocide, according to Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International. Saddam Hussein is right now violating every law of war known to humanity. He is using human shields. He is putting his men in civilian uniform.
Hussein, what about it? There was a lot of blood on this man's hands.
Oh, why didn't we get rid of him when he was using chemical weapons and biological weapons against the Kurds in Halabja? We were on his side. We were supplying him with weapons. You know, what happened overnight? It's our geopolitics have changed.
Well, that's like saying, why did we wind up opposing the Soviet Union when we supported them in World War II? It's exactly the same situation, and I don't see any contradiction between the fact that we ultimately brought down communism and the fact that we were allied with Russia in World War II.
Tom, can I jump in?
Daryl Press and Hussein, thank you for your call. Daryl Press.
I think what's happened in the American political discussion of this is absolutely fascinating, which is that the conservatives have very successful and very effectively taken the moral high ground in this war, because they have a very strong argument which says, look, the regime we're fighting against is a horrific violator of all values we hold dear.
And yet there's a whole argument put up against that there's a whole skein of other interests that muddy that moral water.
Well, you mean there are two arguments put up against that. One of them says, geez, we're not really doing it for moral reasons. We're doing it for interest reasons. And another pacifist version of the moral argument says this isn't moral. But where I was going with this is saying conservative, more hawkish Americans have – and when I say seize the moral high ground, I don't mean that in a disparaging way. They've made a strong moral case for this war. The false dichotomy, though, that I think they're presenting is to say that if you value spreading democracy, if you value liberating people from misery, then you ought to support wars like this. And I guess the response, which I haven't heard enough from opponents of the war, says, listen, we all support democracy. We all support human rights and improving the condition of people around the world. But there are many different tools we have at our disposal to try to advance these values.
Max Boot, 20 seconds. The last word has to go to you. Sorry to oppress.
I agree with that. I think there are many tools. I'm not suggesting that we use military instruments in every case. I think Iraq is a special case because we have, in effect, been at war with Iraq for 12 years, ever since the ceasefire of 1991, which Saddam Hussein violated. Since then, we have tried every possible method to bring Saddam Hussein into compliance with the norms of humanity. Everything from trying to overthrow him to staging uprisings to using weapons inspectors to passing UN resolutions. None of it worked.
And with that,
after
Max Boot, we're out
years,
of time. I'm sorry. I've got to let you go. Max Boot, I want to thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Max Boot is author of The Savage Wars of Peace, Small Wars and the Rise of American Power, and Darrell Press in Hanover, New Hampshire. Thank you for being with us tonight.
It's my pleasure.
Darrell Press is professor of government at Dartmouth College. He's advised the Defense Department for 8 years in military planning for the Gulf. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onepointradio.org and click on forums in a moment. The Supreme Court hears the landmark challenge to the University of Michigan's race-based admissions policy. This is On Point. The Supreme Court today heard arguments over the legality of the University of Michigan's undergraduate and law school admissions policies. The case will determine how and whether race can be a factor when public colleges and universities choose their students. The university rates prospective students on a 150-point scale and gives a 20-point bonus to individuals of races they say are underrepresented at the school. Opponents argue this is equivalent to a quota system. Outside the high court today, thousands of demonstrators rallied in support of affirmative action programs. Here are excerpts from today's Supreme Court hearing. You'll hear attorney Kirk Colbow, who argued on behalf of a white student who was rejected by Michigan, and attorney John Payton, who is defending the university's policy. The excerpts begin with Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg putting a question to Kirk Colbow.
Colbow, because you mentioned the employer and the employer's judgment, I gathered from your brief that this case is not simply about public universities.
Well, Your Honor, I want to be clear about what it is that we're arguing for here today. We are not suggesting an absolute rule forbidding any use of race under any circumstances. What we are arguing is that the interest asserted here by the university, this amorphous, ill-defined, unlimited interest in diversity, is not a compelling interest. Nothing we argue today and nothing we seek to do today would undo the court's precedents that have recognized that some of
I think you are arguing that anything except remedies for past discrimination is impermissible.
Your Honor, that is not a conclusion that we need to follow from this court's decision.
No, I think that's your position, is it not? That the only permissible use of race is as a remedy for past discrimination.
I would not go that far, Justice Stevens. There may be other reasons. I think they would have to be extraordinary and rare, perhaps rising to the level of life or limb.
Or suppose you say you use the word extraordinary as compelling justification, and the other side says, yes, extraordinary. We're 280 million people, large racial diversity within the country. The world is even more diverse. And we think, from the point of view of business, the armed forces, law, etc., that this is an extraordinary need to have diversity among elites throughout the country. That without it, the country will be much worse off. That's what we're being told. In fact, the country might not function well at all. And we have to train those people. We have to. All right, now, how can you say, or can you say, that isn't extraordinary?
Your Honor, because there are important constitutional rights at stake, and those rights are the right to equal protection. And a mere social benefit, that is having more minorities in particular occupations where the school simply doesn't rise to the level of compelling interest. It's simply not, it doesn't remedy a constitutional value.
Like, so if the university president or the dean told you just what Justice Breyer said, you would tell them there's no, and that we have underrepresentation of minorities, you would tell them there's nothing you can do about it.
I would say, Your Honor, that racial preferences are not the answer. If there are problems, again, in not getting a sufficient number of, if minorities are not competing at the same level as other racial groups, then we should take steps to solve that problem. But racial preferences, because they injure the rights of innocent people, because it's a prohibition contained in our Constitution, simply aren't permissible to remedy that problem. If I may reserve the remainder of my time, Chief Justice.
Very well, Mr. Cobo. Mr. Payton, we'll hear from you.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I think I want to spend just a few minutes briefly setting the record straight on why it is the educational judgment of the University of Michigan that the educational benefits that come from a racially and ethnically diverse student body are crucial for all of our students, and why those benefits do not depend in any way on the assumption that, for example, all African Americans think alike. If there are too few African American students, there's a risk that those students will feel that they have to represent their group, their race. This comes from isolation, and it's well understood by educators. It results in these token students not feeling completely comfortable expressing their individuality. On the other hand, if there are meaningful numbers of African American students, this sense of isolation dissipates.
What, Mr. Payne, what is a meaningful number?
It's what we've been referring to as critical mass.
Okay, what is critical mass?
Critical mass is when you have enough of those students so they feel comfortable acting as individuals. If you have the meaningful numbers of minority students, what then happens is that students will see a range of ideas, a range of viewpoints from and among those students, and they will then see things that they may not have expected, similarities and differences. And those, in turn, will have the result of undermining stereotypes.
But where we are is there's an assumption, you may not agree with it, but it's one beginning assumption in this area, that there may not be a quota. All of the eloquent things you said could be easily met by a quota. That, let's just assume for argument, we cannot do. I have to say that In looking at your program, it looks to me like this is just a disguised quota.
Here's how our system works, and I believe it's not a quota at all, and I believe I can simply explain this. Every single application is read in its entirety by a counselor. It is, in fact, judged on the basis of the selection index, which has the 20 points for race and 20 points for athletics, but it also has all sorts of other things that it values, in-state, underrepresented state, underrepresented county within Michigan, socioeconomic status, what your school is like, what the curriculum that you took at your school is like,
none of that matters.
Grade.
None of that matters. If you're minimally qualified and you're one of the minority races that gets the 20 points, you're in.
The rest is
really irrelevant.
The way it works is that every application comes through and it's read in its entirety. It is evaluated, taking all of these factors into account. And then, based upon the number that comes off the selection index, which can go up to 150, the students are all competing against each other. There is a score. And if the score is higher, you are in. And that doesn't matter about anything other than what the score is.
Excerpts from today's Supreme Court hearing on the University of Michigan's race-based admissions policy final questions there from Justice Anthony Kennedy. A decision is expected in July. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.